Mary sends her regrets. She is on a work training out of state, and she's having a good time, but she couldn't be here tonight, so she says hi. If you look at your outline, at the top of your outline there's a question or statement, the worst things in my life. What are the worst things that have ever happened to you? What are the things that you scratch your head and you say, why did that happen? And what was God thinking? What is going on? It might be something you're involved in now. It may be something in the past. What is it? And I'm sure it's different for all of us. For some of us, it's relational. For some of us, it's physical or financial. It might be abuse or neglect that you experienced or trauma. I don't know what it is for you. But these are the things where you say, God, you could have done better. You could have done this different. And one of those for me, I think I've shared this with you before, is when I was a little boy, I hardly have a memory of not having death in our family. And before I was 16, I counted and, you know, I had 16 family members, close family members, die. So it was just constantly. And I didn't understand it as a kid, but looking back as an adult, it's like, God, I wouldn't wish that kind of a childhood on anybody. You know, somebody's worst nightmares have a child experience that much death so consistently, so regularly, so close, and be there as it's happening. It's just too much. And so I've wrestled with God about that and said, why? But you've got something, and it may be very different than that, but what is it? And the reason why as we go through the passage tonight, the book, carry those thoughts, those questions with you and apply the book as we read it to those situations where you struggle and try to apply the ideas and the concepts in the text and that we look at to your situation and use it to cry out to God. Now, on the left-hand side of your outline, it says why. And this is from the first chapter, verses 2-4. Read along with me. Listen as I read. How long, Lord? How long must I call for help and you do not listen? Or cry out to you about violence and you do not save? Why do you force me to look at all this injustice? Why do you tolerate wrongdoing, oppression, and violence are right in front of me? Strife is ongoing and conflict escalates. This is why the law is inefficient and justice never emerges. For the wicked restrict the righteous. Therefore, justice, when it does come out, is perverted. This is the cry of a frustrated man. But what we learn from the Bible, and we learn in this book, is that it's okay to cry out to God. Give God your heart. Pour it out to him. Tell him what you're thinking. You say, well, I don't know if I like that. I don't know if I believe that. Can you give me an example? And I say, yeah, the Psalms. Read the Psalms. A lot of them are just saying, God, what are you doing? Or read the prophets. You know, one thinks of Lamentations. You know, the people of God go to God and say, I have a problem. I have a beef. You say, well, that's not good enough. That's too far away. Well, how about Jesus, you know? In the garden, sweating great drops of blood, pouring out his heart to his Father. And then when he's on the cross, he says, God, why? God, why? It's okay to cry out to God. It's okay to pour your heart out and to tell him what you think he's doing wrong in your life or in the world. But as we see in the book of Habakkuk, he comes to a place, and we want to go through that journey too, where we process our pain and our trials and the bad things that happen to us, and we get to chapter 3 where he's praising God. Even though he knows there's an army going to invade and take his people captive. So it's a journey, it's a process. Now, there's a fancy word on the front of your outline, theodicy. which is a big fancy word for defending God's goodness in the face of evil. And this is a big study of philosophers. It's a big study for theologians. It's like, how do you reconcile these things when bad things happen that God allows? And this is exactly what the book is talking about. And we're not going to exhaustively address that. You know, big, thick books have been written on this subject. But this illustration that's in the center of your outline where it says evil and it has these seven arrows pointing at it, for me, speaking just for me, this has been the most helpful answer to this question for me that I've experienced. Because I've read the books, the theology books and the philosophy books, and so many of them are just like, blah, 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 blah. What does that even mean? I don't know. Well, this helps me. It's not original with me. I lifted it from this book, if you want to come see it sometime. And he takes these seven areas and he says, to understand evil and why God allows the evil in my life, in your life, in the history of Israel, and in the current times, we have to look at it not from just one angle, but to look at it from seven different angles. And then when you put them, and just one of these might not convince you. You might go, that's too weak. It's just, you know, one leg on the stool. Well, you have seven legs on the stool, and you put them together, and it begins to make more sense. I'm going to start at the top left, where it has that infinity symbol. To understand the evil in the world, in the Bible, and in my life, I have to have an accurate view of eternity. Now, what I've done, I encourage you to do, if you have a pen, I've written another one word around each of these items and circles, and I put time here. If we think about our pain right now, it doesn't seem just, it doesn't seem fair, but if we give it enough time, it makes more sense. And you think about your own self or sending a child to the dentist, and it's like, you want me to go in there and be tortured by that man in a mask for 2 hours or whatever it is? Yes. Well, I have a problem. The child is like, I have a problem with that. Trust me, it's going to hurt for 2 or 3 hours. It's really going to hurt, and it's going to cost me a lot. But you'll feel better for the next 10 years, and that tooth won't be a problem for a long time. So you go, oh, and we all look back, and we've been through these painful experiences, and we say, with the benefit of time, I understand better. The second one is the question mark there, and it has to do with our limited understanding. Our limited understanding in our natural selves, none of us is that smart. If I had a PhD in linguistics, right, do I know everything about languages? No, there's 5,000 plus languages. I might impress you and say, I know 10. Well, what's 10 compared to 5,000? We all have limited awareness and limited understanding. And I put the word ignorance. We're ignorant. And in comparison to God, he's doing things, and his knowledge, his awareness, his plan is so much bigger than ours. And even the smartest, you know, the most naturally intelligent, the most deeply studied among us, we're ignorant compared to him. And then there's those balances, the scales, and it says existence as a consequence. Sometimes evil arises as a consequence. And I don't have a good illustration for this, but you can make up your own. I think of that bumper sticker. I don't recommend you get it, but it says ignorance, you know, should be painful. You know, so basically, if you're suffering in your life, it's because, you know, you're a stupid person and you deserve it. I don't necessarily believe that. But the idea is we all do things in our life and we look back and it's like, that cost me. And or we did something positive. You know, some of us know someone who invested $100,000 in Microsoft, you know, 30 years ago or whatever it was. And it's like they're now experiencing the consequence of that choice. But we're for our purposes tonight, we're looking at evil. Sometimes we make choices that lead, the consequences lead to evil. And then there's the ability, there's the megaphone there, the ability of evil or pain in our lives has a power to draw us in and to refocus our life. And all of us, there's a sense in which when we go through a painful thing, we find out what's most important. And I think all of us, and I feel this way, if I had to go on a four-hour plane flight, and I had to sit next to someone who was born with a silver spoon in their mouth, never experienced any pain in their life, or sit next to someone who's really suffered and been through a trauma, a war. I would always choose the person who suffered. And that's because I can learn from them and what they've been through. That helps us understand the evil in our that we experience and that we see in the world around us. And then there's the role of character development that we deal with when we have processed the pain and the suffering, the bad things that come into our life. We grow through our suffering. We grow through enduring. You know, some of us are following the Olympics a little bit. Well, no great athlete gets anywhere, and they don't grow in character, and they don't grow in their skill and their sport unless they experience pain and suffering. And then there's love, the appropriate definition of love. And again, on this one, I think of children. I even think of myself as a child. I remember thinking as a child of 4 or 5 years old, I remember thinking, I have bad parents. I have really bad parents. I don't think they know me. I don't think they love me. Why? Because we get up on Saturday morning, and they make me do chores. We should be going to Knott's Berry Farm. Every Saturday, we should be going. It was free in those days. We should be at Knott's Berry Farm, and I should be walking down Main Street with my six-shooter on, you know? And that was the most fun. And I thought my parents weren't good parents because they didn't take me. They only took me twice a year or once a year, whatever it was. I should be there all the time. And it's because I had an inappropriate definition of love. And when you love a child, you make them study math, you make them study history, you make them study French or whatever it is, and they don't like it. And they say, you're a bad parent, you don't love me. And it's like, yes, I do. And God lets us go through things sometimes because of his love. And then there's this issue of proper reverence for free agency. And this just means we're free to make decisions, and God gives us this libertarian free will. He allows us to make decisions, and he allows other people to make decisions, and sometimes they make decisions that are bad or evil or foolish or stupid, whatever we call it, and those have negative consequences towards us. Anyway, run the bad things in your life through this grid and see if it's helpful to you. It's been very helpful for me. Now let's look at the book itself for a bit. If you look at the top right on that overview place, we'll see an outline of the book. There's basically the book is two, Habakkuk gives a prayer to God, and then God responds, and he prays again, and then God responds again. And in his second response, God tells Habakkuk what he thinks of the Babylonians, and we learn some things from that. And then finally, there's a third and a closing prayer, and in that, Habakkuk expresses his confidence, newfound confidence in God, after he's been through this argument, dialogue, praying, hearing from God, thinking about it from God's perspective. Now, we've already read the first prayer in the first four verses, and basically in this section, he's just saying, why? And he accuses God, you don't save, you don't listen, you tolerate wrongdoing, justice never emerges, justice is perverted. And God, in verses 5 through 11 of chapter 1, his response is, he says, Habakkuk, you need to hold on. I'm not going to capitulate. It's worse than you think. He says, look at the nations and observe, be utterly astounded, for I am doing something in your days. Habakkuk is saying, God, you're not doing anything. He says, no, I am doing something in your days that you will not believe, even when you hear about it. Look, I am raising up the Chaldeans, the Babylonians, that bitter, impetuous nation that marches across the earth, open spaces to seize territories. So basically, you know the story. He says, it's not fair what you're doing with the Babylonians, he says, it's not fair what's happening to us in our people, in the sin and the evil we're experiencing. And God says, it's worse, I'm going to send the Babylonians to discipline you, to take you into exile. And he goes from saying, what? He changes and he's like, what? He goes from saying, why? And he begins to say, what? I can't believe that you would do that. But God says he's going to send the Babylonians to judge them. And then in his second prayer, he has more dialogue with God, and he shares with him what he thinks of him. And I glommed on to verse 14. He's telling God how he feels. He says, you've made mankind like the fish of the sea. And we might think of chess. You know, you just move us around like chess pieces on the board. The Babylonians here, the Chaldeans there, the Israelites here. And he says, we're just like fish in your aquarium. You've made us like the fish of the sea, like marine creatures that have no ruler. And this, I guess it comes to mind because several weeks ago, Mary and I took a couple of our grandkids crabbing for the first time. It was first time for Mary and I, and it was first time for them. And they're little, and they had a blast to catch the crab. And we had fun, too. And I hadn't started studying this passage. This was a month or two ago. But I was struck how easy it was to catch the crab. And how I was the boss, you know. I can catch crab. And the crab, I have a big, big brain, and they got a little tiny brain. And they think they're so bad with their claws. But no, I'm in charge. And Habakkuk is saying, that's how I feel. I feel like a crab. And you just move us around, and you throw us in a pot and boil us, and we have no say in it. And God responds again, and he starts in chapter 2 and in verse 1. And then Habakkuk says in chapter 2, I've shared my beef with you, now I'll wait and listen for your reply. And God begins to reply in chapter 2 in verse 4. Let's start with 4. He's talking about the Babylonian king, and he says, the king, his ego is inflated. He is without integrity. But, this famous verse, but the righteous one will live by his faith. So God is acknowledging, yes, you feel small. Yes, you feel beat down. Yes, you're experiencing pain. You're experiencing evil. You're about to experience the judgment of God through the hand of the Chaldeans, the Babylonians. You don't get it. You don't understand. And he's kind of saying, but you got to trust me. And we're like, I don't know if I can. And you look around the world today and you say, God, I don't know if I can trust you. You know, I read the news headlines every day. I'm like, God, do you know what you're doing? And he says, you got to trust me because I see the nations moving around the world. I'm involved in that. And you, God's people, me, you, the Jewish people of that time, he's like, you have to live by faith. You have to live by faith. And then he launches in chapter 2, God does through the prophet Habakkuk, and he gives these 5 woes. And I'll try to go through these fast. We could spend a whole lesson on these 5, but we'll just briefly go over them. First, he accuses the Babylonians, and he says he will eventually judge them. After he's used them to discipline the Jews, he's going to judge the Babylonians for their violence, their bloodthirstiness, the bloodshed, for the way they get wealth by stealing from others, and their injustice. Look at verse 14. It says, for the earth, 2:14. For the earth will be filled with the knowledge of the Lord as the waters covers the sea. I apologize. I'm confused on this. I think I've lost my place. So I'll go on to the next one. I'll just pretend I didn't say anything. But this next one though is curious because it has a three-letter word in it that always gets attention, but it's in the text. Verse 15 says, "Woe to him who gives his neighbor drink, pouring out your wrath, and even making them drunk in order to look at their nakedness." And then he says, "You will be filled with disgrace." So what he's saying is he's giving these woes against the Babylonians. They're violent, they're bloodthirsty, they're greedy, they steal from others, they don't provide justice where they go, they're selfish. And then they use intoxicants, in their case alcohol, to get sex. And God says, "I'm going to judge you for that." And we live in a culture where sex and intoxicants go together. And I think the most famous popular example of this is Dr. Bill Cosby. And, you know, that he went to jail for this. He would give women intoxicants, not alcohol necessarily, but any, you know, whatever he had. And he did time for that. He got out too soon, but you could say, "Well, I'm glad you mentioned him because I'm nothing like that." Right, right. Everyone in this room has misused a substance, whether it's food or sugar, tobacco, alcohol, legal drugs, you know, doctor-prescribed drugs, or sugar or caffeine. We've all abused some substance. And all of us, we may have kept ourselves together sexually, but all of us have had impure thought, what the Bible would call impure thoughts or adulterous thoughts, as Jesus said. And so these examples, we can say, "Oh, we're not as bad as the Babylonians who did this in spades. We're not as bad as the Bill Cosbys of the world. We're not as bad as all of that." But we all have something that we can learn, and we'll come back to this. And then this last one is idolatry. They worshiped their own gods, and God says he's going to judge them for their idolatry. Then Habakkuk goes into his third prayer, and this starts in chapter 3. And look at verse 2. "Lord, I have heard the report about you." So now he's gone from accusing God and yelling at God and crying out why. He says, "Lord, now I stand in awe." He's starting to shift, isn't he? He starts out kind of angry, frustrated, and now he says, "I'm in awe of you." After hearing what God has said to him, he says, "I'm in awe of you and of your deeds." And he prays, "Revive your work in these days, make it known in these years, and in your wrath on your people and on the Assyrians, or excuse me, the Babylonians, and in your judgments in the world, remember mercy." And we say the same thing to God. We say, "God, I deserve your discipline in all of these areas, in my thought life, in my finances, in my way I do my civics, the way I think about sexuality, the way I think about spirituality. But God, so God, discipline me, but be merciful at the same time." And then finally, in the third, the last instance there, Habakkuk's confidence in God increases, and he ends the book with this psalm of praise. And isn't it interesting that, you know, Habakkuk is, he's a real musician, isn't he, band? He's a musician. He's a poet. And this book, he's dealing with one of the hardest, most complicated philosophical, theological topics that has ever existed. You know, how do you deal with evil in the world? But he does it in a way that's very, not romantic isn't the right word, what helped me out here, artistic and poetic and musical and that's how I encourage myself and you to deal with these things too. Don't just come at it with your brain, and don't just come at it with your emotions, but bring them all together and say, "God, I have these emotions, but I'm going to apply my brain to these issues and questions that I have with you in my life or what I see happening in the world." So you say, "George, that's you know, this is three chapters. We can't cover three chapters so fast. You've lost me in the weeds. You know, I'm you know." Okay, well we're going to do the whole book in three easy words. You ready for that? Bottom left, here's Habakkuk in a nutshell. In chapter 1, he's crying out, why? In chapter 2, he's waiting, and then he says, what? And then in chapter 3, he begins to worship. And that's the journey we're on. We can bring our why to God, and we then should wait, and we should listen to him. We should hear what he has to say, how he responds to our questions. And then hopefully we come at the end to a place of, we stand in awe of him, and we begin to worship. And I told this idea to Mary. She says, how's this going in your study? I said, oh, I got this idea. I said, he starts out in chapter 1, he's talking about the why questions, and in chapter 3 at the end, he's talking about who. He's talking about God. He's talking about the character of God. She goes, oh, that'll preach. And I'm like, yeah, that'll preach. So we got to go from the why to the who. We got to take the focus sometimes off of our own pain and the evil we see, and we got to look at the one God who created the heavens and the earth, see him and worship him. That's Habakkuk in a nutshell. And the big theological idea and takeaway from this, it's in that box where it says big idea, is God is disciplining his people. He's disciplining us. He's disciplining his church. We pray at some point he'll discipline Portland and Oregon and the United States and all the nations of the world. He is in the process of, in this book, of disciplining Judah through the Babylonians. And here's an interesting thing. I believe these are historical, real events, but this his final destruction of Babylon, ultimately, and he did destroy Babylon, it represents all of our lives. Because now, for us, today, before the Lord returns, before the final day, before the last judgment, before God reconciles heaven and earth together, where the space we live in now, we're like Habakkuk, and we say, God, what are you doing? God says, you got to live by faith. It's three chapters that kind of boils down our whole lives for us, and saying we're in the same position. We see what God is doing, and we're not sure we understand. And we dialogue with him, and we learn from him, and we study his character, and then we say at the end, I'm going to trust you, and I'm going to live by faith. And we'll see a little bit later. And I'm going to work on my own sin. I'm not just going to throw stones at the Babylonians. I'm going to see and why God is disciplining me. You say, well, George, you know, Habakkuk is like all the prophets. It's kind of a downer, you know, dealing with evil, shouting at God. That's just so heavy. It's so negative. And I would say in response, yeah it is. But here's some hope. I thought, where's the hope in this book? And it's in that circle down there, our future. And I think in the midst of the pain of this book and the subject matter, there is tremendous hope in this. We see in chapter 1, in verse 5, look at the nations and observe, be utterly astounded, for I am doing something in your days. So our future, our personal, our national, our church, our world eschatology is that God is doing something. Our accusation is, God, you're not doing anything. And he says, oh, I am doing something. And wait till you see it. And then in chapter 2 and in verse 3, he says this, for the vision is yet for the appointed time. It's in the future. It testifies about the end, and it will not lie. Though it delays, wait for it, since it will certainly come and not be late. Now, there's a sermon in that verse all by itself. God has a plan for the future. He is going to work his plan. And then look at chapter 2 and verse 14. It says, for the earth will be filled with the knowledge of the glory of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. God's glory will win. God's glory will be revealed. And it will be revealed in us and in the church and in the nations and in the state and the nation, the people of Israel. He is in control. He is doing things for his glory. And I won't read it again, but it says, our future is by faith in God. Our future, if we stay in the arguing and fighting and crying out to God, that's not a happy place. But as we walk in faith, we will see later in the book, he gives us his strength and he lifts us up emotionally and otherwise. Now look at chapter 2 and verse 20. And in this verse, we see that God remains in control. We think he's not, but he is. But the Lord is in his holy temple. And let the whole earth be silent in his presence. God's in control. I read in the news this week, maybe you saw it, the Chinese army and the Russian army, they did some military exercises this week. You know, did you hear about this? Do you know where they did it? Right off the coast of Alaska, you know? So I'm like, look at this. The Chinese army and the Russian army are up there. I don't want to give any untoward gestures, but they're flexing their muscles at us, you know, just and saying, we're here, we could just take Alaska if we wanted. And we have to say, God is in control. And we look at all the conflicts around the world, all the conflicts in your soul right now, God is still in control. And he's going to display in his time and in his way, his power. Look at chapter 3 and verse 15. God will display his power. And in this whole section, verses 2 through 15, he talks about his power. And this one, because I love the sea and I've been talking about fish in the sea, this verse that stuck out to me. You tread the sea with your horses, stirring up the vast water. And so God is showing Habakkuk that he's strong. And I think of this like he says, we're just like fish in your pond, you know. And here he says, you tread the sea, the oceans, with your horses. And then those horses stir up the oceans in a storm. But to me, it's like when you were a little kid, I don't know if you had one of these one-foot pools about this big around and, you know, kids in their diapers playing them. Well, whatever pool it was, we had a game we would play. We'd dig a whirlpool, remember? So you get two or three kids and you have to swim or run or push around and get the water going as fast as you can and quick turn around and try to swim through it. Well, that's what we did. And it's like he's saying the same thing. He's like, you know, we think God's out of control. He says, no, I'm just playing whirlpool, you know, and you just happen to be in the pool. But he's in control, and he's going to show us his power. And so we have to wait, chapter 3 and verse 16. When Habakkuk heard this, he says, I heard and I trembled within, and my lips quivered at the sound. To him, it's not a game. You know, it's no playing around. It's not a little kiddie game. He says, I was scared to death, and rottenness entered my bones, and I trembled where I stood. What am I going to do? Now I must quietly wait for the day of distress to come against the people invading us. So it's in our future. We're waiting for God. We're waiting for him to act, and he will. And then we get to the fun part in chapter 3 and verse 18, where it says this, I will celebrate in the Lord, and I will rejoice in the God of my salvation. He's seen the power of God, and then he's waiting on the power of God, and then he begins to rejoice in God. And just as Habakkuk went through these steps of seeing who God is, and who he is, and what he's doing, that he has a plan, putting faith in him, understanding his glorious power and control, he begins to wait, and he begins to rejoice, and he begins to realize that it says in verse 19, the Lord is going to lift us up. The Lord, my God, is my strength. He makes my feet like those of a deer and enables me to walk on mountain heights. God is going to lift us up. He's going to lift you up. He's going to lift me up. But right now, we don't understand always, do we? Turn your outline over. You say, well, this is, let me say this too, you know, going through this, our future is all these things, you know, hoping in the glory and the power of God. Yes, 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 and amen. But as I was driving here tonight and I was praying, I was like, God, I believe this, but I don't practice it perfectly. And I'm guessing some of you don't. There's probably a couple of you who do. Raise your hand. No. You know, most of us don't practice, but this is our future, and this is something we can come back to and take counsel from when we face the most difficult, challenging situations in our life. Say, okay, well, this is just a little three-chapter book, you know, Minor Prophet in the Old Testament. What does it have to do with anything? Well, some of you may know this, three New Testament books base their entire argument on this book. It's a pretty big deal. Romans, Galatians, and Hebrews frame their entire argument, theological arguments around this phrase, the just shall live by faith. And in their debates with those who would say, no, it's faith and this, it's faith and that, it's God plus that, they're like, no, the just will live by faith. And so this book, the message of this book, shaped the theology, the character, the thinking of the apostles. And it shaped the thinking and the character and the theology of a guy, Martin Luther, who started the Protestant Reformation. It was his insight into this book, into this, and the 2:14, where it says, the just shall live by faith. It was that that shifted his whole brain. It's like, I can't do enough. I have to just trust him and put my faith and my trust in him. And this is what Romans 1:17 says, for I am not ashamed of the gospel, because it is the power of God for salvation to everyone who believes. For the Jew, first for the Jew and also for the Greek. For in it, the gospel, the righteousness of God is revealed from faith to faith, just as it is written, and he quotes Habakkuk, the righteous will live by faith. And then in Galatians 3, it says, now it is clear that no one is justified before God by the law. Why? Because the righteous aren't justified before God by anything, but not by their works. The righteous will live by faith. Again, quoting Habakkuk. And so if you're here tonight and you haven't done this, I encourage you to turn from your sins, to believe in Jesus, and put all of your faith in him. Because, as Martin Luther discovered, the just will live by faith. You're not going to get to God by being good or religious or spiritual or holy or giving money or you know, causing more pain to yourself or doing something crazy. You just turn from your sins and trust in Jesus. That's it. And then Hebrews 10, it says, and this is, I think he's turned his guns to us, the believer. This is for us. For you need endurance. You need endurance. I need endurance. So that after you have done God's will, you may receive what was promised. Now it's like he's just preaching Habakkuk. For in a very little while, the coming one, Jesus, will come, and he will not delay. But my righteous one will live by faith. And if he draw back, I have no pleasure in him. But we are not those who draw back and are destroyed, but we are those who have faith in God and are saved. And this goes together perfectly with what I'm saying is the big idea of the book, is that God's discipline of Judah and of us and his destruction of the Babylonians is a representation of what he is doing, not just in Israel and with its neighbors. It's what he's doing in our lives, and it's what he's doing in the whole world. He's bringing his glory, his justice to everyone. He's going to bring the day of final judgment, the day of final reconciliation, and we're waiting now for that to happen. And in the meantime, we live by faith. So what do we learn from this? We learn from the Babylonians. You say, no, we can't learn from the Babylonians. They're the bad guys. Well, we learn from their bad example. We learn from their mistakes. And we see in the text that the Babylonian, in history, that the Babylonians were proud. And they were violent. And they were greedy. They were unrighteous. They were impure, drunk, unchaste, perverse. They didn't worship God. They worshiped themselves, and they worshiped idols. So we say, what can we learn from that? Well, we just flip that thing over, and we try to do the opposite. So ours should be, and I want you to think now this way. Take those things that we talked about at the beginning, the worst things in your life, the bad things, the horrible things, the painful things, the costly things, and run them through this grid. What is my mindset towards God and others as I deal with my pain and the evil that I've experienced? Do I have a mindset of humility? Come at it with humility. And when you think about God and you're accusing him and asking him your questions, come with faith and not with anxiety. And in our relationships with one another, don't be like the Babylonians who are violent. Be a person of peace. Deal with your anxiety and your pain and your loss peacefully, not violently. And the Babylonians were greedy with their money, and we should be content instead. And in their civics and their dealings with others, they were unrighteous and unjust. And God calls us in our civics to tell the truth, to speak justice, love mercy. In their sexuality, the Babylonians were horrible. We would call them criminal even now. And God calls us, his people, to sexual purity and to sobriety. And then spiritually, they were into idol worship and they felt so great about themselves. And Habakkuk learned in his process with God and seeing the power of God to worship him and to trust him. So I join you in seeking to apply this book to our lives. And this is a great book. And I don't want to forget it soon. And I hope you feel the same. And I hope that you will use this book to understand God in your own suffering better, to understand evil in the world. And I ask you to pray quietly as I close with a prayer, a song. Just pray quietly and pray to God about the things that have happened to you and how he might help you to deal with them and process them. Although the fig tree will not blossom, neither be there fruit there in the vine, though the labor of the olive shall fail, and the fields shall yield no meat, although the herd be cut off from the stall, yet I will rejoice in the Lord. I will glory in the God of my salvation. Yet I will rejoice in the Lord. I will glory in the God of my salvation.